Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma, and I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by Robert Gross, who's Professor of Energy Policy and Technology at Imperial College and Director of the UK Energy Research Centre, UKIRC. And he's joined by Malcolm Kay, who is Senior Research Fellow at the OIES. And we're here today to discuss the key messages that came from Robert's article, arguing over the fundamentals of market reform is undermining investment and impeding energy transition, that was published in the Institute's May 2023 Oxford Energy Forum publication that was titled Electricity Market Design During the Energy Transition and the Energy Crisis. Robert, Malcolm, welcome to the OIS podcast series.
David, thanks very much for inviting me. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. I'm looking forward to the conversation very much.
Good morning, everyone. This is Malcolm Kay. I'm also delighted to be here and look forward to it.
Fantastic. Well, look, Rob, why don't I come to you first, if I may, because your article in the Oxford Energy Forum emphasises the need for any changes in the UK electricity market design to be gradual in order to maintain the momentum of investment in clean generation. Indeed, you seem to have reservations about the open-ended nature of the government's current consultation. So, do you think the present market design system based on short-run marginal cost is basically okay, or is changing it simply a lower priority than getting to net zero?
Well, I do think that it's most fundamental that market design is a lower priority than getting to net zero. I'm very, very much in the pragmatists' camp. I think that moving to a largely decarbonised or wholly decarbonised electricity system in the sort of timeframe that's being discussed is unprecedentedly difficult challenge slash probably impossible. Although I don't want that to be cast as a kind of, you know, gloom and negative. I think we try, to be honest, I think everyone's got very preoccupied with particular targets and including even the net zero target. I think what we're looking to do is radically, dramatically reduce our carbon emissions and to almost entirely or entirely decarbonize our electricity system and make it, hopefully, if we do it right, more secure and of a form of energy that's more stable in terms of the effects of geopolitical factors on prices, as we've seen with the war in Ukraine and their impact on gas supplies, so hopefully more secure in that sense. So yes, that is more important than the details of market design, no question about it. And my concern about this, what's called REMA, the Review of Electricity Market Arrangements, is there's nothing wrong with being open-minded. I think that there is a problem if it's so open-handed that it's essentially rudderless. And I think that what we're seeing at the moment is a review that's quite rudderless. I'm not quite sure, you know, there's no big political imperative that's driving it. In fact, the government has repeatedly said it quite likes things like the contracts for difference because they've been successful at delivering some of their objectives, for example, in offshore wind. So, yes, I think it's going on for too long. It's probably going to get kicked over the election boundary now. And I don't think it's sufficiently directed. We can obviously get into the detail of different changes and different policies and some of the kind of political philosophy around the role of markets and the role of governments, and I'm sure we will. My concern is it's taking too long. We don't really know where it's going. And what's really important is the energy transformation in a real sense.
Well, look, Malcolm, why did I turn to you? Because, you know, you see a need to start a process of kind of more fundamental reforms. But you know, wouldn't that simply create uncertainty and inhibit needed investment?
I don't think it need do so. Unlike Rob, I do see a fundamental problem with the present market organisation. And while I agree with the need to maintain the momentum of investment, there's no point in doing so if you're building the wrong things, as I think we are doing just now. What's happening just now is the government's making all the decisions. It's focusing on generation upstream, not on the system as a whole. And it's designing a system which won't make sense. There's an awful lot of investment taking place. And if you build the wrong stuff, you've got a legacy that's going to go on for generations of an inefficient system. I think the problem of inhibiting investment can be dealt with by transitional arrangements, which will keep matters going, essentially through the same sorts of measures as at present. But unless you have some idea about the end result and where we're going to, you're still going to put the emphasis on, to my mind, the wrong sort of investment. And I don't agree with Rob that getting the wrong investment is better than anything else.
Rob, if I can come back to you. Now, you quantify the cost of uncertainty. Each extra percentage point on the required rate of return for offshore wind would add, what, $1 billion to system costs. Now, this sounds a lot, but there are also risks the other way. For instance, Hinkley Point C is now expected to cost, what, over £32 billion. And many would argue that it's not the right choice anyway when the main need is for system flexibility. So is there not a risk that on your approach, governments will end up making expensive mistakes like they have in the past?
There probably is. And I'll be fairly straightforward about that. But I would want to sort of clarify a little bit. I'm not really advocating for a process of picking winners. You know, I'd also question some of the decisions that have been made around Hinkley. I'd question why it was necessary to be quite as prescriptive about the set of technologies that were eligible for the CFD rounds that have been tendered over the last few years. So for political reasons, until quite recently, the government had only run what are called Pot 2 auctions, which were initially for the less mature technologies that included offshore wind but excluded onshore wind. And the government had committed in the 2015 election not to provide any more support for onshore wind because some of their voters didn't like onshore wind. So my preference actually would be to have a more technology neutral approach that still relies upon the CFDs. And for those CFDs to be evolved to encourage more flexibility on the part of the generators. But I think where I don't entirely agree, much as I respect Malcolm's views, I don't entirely agree with him, is that I think that we do have a sense of what the endpoint ought to be. And I think that there aren't a kind of an unlimited number of options available to us. And I think that what we know about the options that are available to us suggests to me that we need to be moving to re-engineer our system to be largely renewables-based, and that for the most part, those renewables are in particular, you know, we need to think about the geography of those renewables. And if we're going to be exploiting the wind resources that the UK has, we need to be clear that that means that we need new transmission lines, and that we need to be particularly taking advantage of our offshore wind, but also our onshore resources in Scotland, for example, and in other parts of the country, which are not where we built our transmission system. So I know we're coming probably later, we're going to come on to talk a bit about locational marginal pricing, so I don't want to immediately skip to that. I think I definitely understand Malcolm's concern about a propensity to pick winners and to kind of to plan the system. I'd argue that maybe historically in most countries, in most points in history, much of the electricity system actually has been planned. And I wonder, and maybe, you know, we don't have time to get into everything today, I wonder whether really it's possible to imagine such a profound and radical transformation without quite a strong role for planning. And I guess what we want to avoid is a halfway house where we do a bit, we plan a bit, and we don't plan a bit, and we say we're going to use markets, but we don't really use markets. But the particular report that you refer to with the £1 billion per year percentage point analysis, that was a kind of piece of, it was a what if piece of work. You know, we looked at the various different energy system scenarios that have been created by National Grid Energy System Operator in their future energy scenarios. And we looked at the mix of generation options they had in their different scenarios and the mix of flexibility that was available in those different scenarios. And then we kind of reverse engineered how much market price risk offshore wind operator, a kind of imaginary merchant offshore wind operator, would be exposed to under different policy arrangements. And that is the kind of one percentage point and a billion that you come to. In those scenarios, there is a large amount of offshore wind. In some of those scenarios, there's what a large amount of what's called price cannibalization, which means that when it's windy, the price collapses, and there's not a lot of flexibility available. In those instances, it's expensive because it's risky to build offshore wind. And so really, in our kind of what-if scenario, we're saying, well, look, if you're an imaginary merchant offshore wind investor, you don't really know where the system's going to end up because everything's changing. And so if you want to continue to encourage those investors to be building stuff, you need your policy environment to offer them some degree of protection against all sorts of the vagaries of uncertainty. And the other concept we're quite keen on at the moment is this idea of transition risk. And by that, we mean everything's changing at once. You know, we want to get all of these electric vehicles onto the system. We want to get all of these heat pumps. But we'll only be able to do that if policy is successful. And we'll only be able to do that if we're able to persuade, you know, tens of millions of householders to do stuff which they might not actually really particularly be all that keen on. And there's a bit of a backlash growing against some of this. And so, you know, if you are an imaginary or real market participant, you're looking at all of this risk, it's very difficult for you. And I actually quite liked what Malcolm said about transition arrangements, because I think that what we're talking about here is how we get through this next decade of change.
Why did I come to you, Malcolm, then, on that? Because your approach seems to rely for its effectiveness on active consumer participation. But is there any evidence that consumers are actually interested?
Well, I think the problem here is not so much that people have tried to get consumers interested and failed, as that they haven't really tried very much in the past. That there have been very few serious attempts to engage consumers. Where there have been, and an example is the Economy 7 tariff in the UK and its predecessors, night rates. When you have a rate that's packaged in with equipment, is very simple, offers some sort of long-term guarantee, people do respond to it. And it made a very big difference to consumer behaviour. Although we've used the word active consumer participation, it doesn't have to be active in a sense. It can be passive. It can be participation that's enabled by the equipment that they get. The problem with the present approach is because it all focuses on the upstream, there's very little attention given to what consumers actually want. And to take one example, Rob's talked about the transition and the growth of electric vehicles. Well, that is as much an opportunity as a challenge. Electric vehicles, if you can persuade electric vehicle owners to charge at times when there is surplus electricity, then you've got a win-win situation. So looking at the consumer end is important both to help consumers and to help the system as a whole, and to ensure that the ultimate investment is driven in a way which meets consumers' preferences, not just the government's ex-ante prejudices, which may be based and often are based really on a rather old-fashioned view of what the electricity system looks like, not a proper view of what the new system, which, as Rob says, will change very fundamentally, will look like. And that's what I'm worried about, that we're going to get into a fossilized system which won't really work for the 21st century.
Now, Rob, your approach focuses on de-risking generation and says really little about the other options, interconnection, storage, demand flexibility, for example, you know, which might also need de-risking. So might not this approach tend to lead to an unbalanced system?
If that was the only thing that we were concerned about, then yes, you'd be right. So I think there's a particular conversation around what kind of incentives or what forms of support are provided for investment in new forms of generation, in particular in the UK context. You know, yes, we're going to build a bit of solar, probably quite a large amount of solar. But I do think that if we're looking to a largely renewables dominated system, then the kind of backbone of that will be wind, because that's just our geography. I mean, a lovely sunny day as we're recording this, but, you know, it's not particularly lovely and sunny during the middle of December, and that's when demand is highest. And I think that, you know, it is important to understand these geographical specificities. And we're thinking about, you know, Malcolm's view of a very much more active system, which I don't disagree with at all. But you can imagine in California, it's very different. So if you're imagining some countries, or in Spain, or, you know, where they've got a better solar resource, maybe they've got a more even distribution of available renewables, maybe a more focus on decentralized generation, to a country like the UK, where maybe what we really need to be thinking about is that not all renewables are decentralized. And some of our best resources are actually quite concentrated in parts of the country where we don't currently have any don't have much network capacity. And so we need to be thinking about the problem in the whole. I think we need to continue to de-risk the investment in the generation assets, because otherwise we haven't really got a problem to solve, because the generation asset build out just won't happen, or it'll be slower or much more expensive than it needs to be. We absolutely need to be providing incentives for flexibility. We absolutely need to be getting network investment away. There's controversy. There's a story in the FT just the other day about the power lines that they want to build through East Anglia are becoming very controversial politically. So we need to tackle all of those things. We need to do those interconnections to build that to build the networks. You know, we are moving from a system which is largely 2/3 of which is the direct combustion of fossil fuels in homes and in vehicles, to a system where we're using a lot more electricity. We'll be using hydrogen for some stuff as well, but that's another conversation. And so we need to build new wires, and there's no way that we can get around that. In terms of flexibility, I completely agree with Malcolm. I mean, we did a piece of work about the demand side, demand response, a few years ago now, looking at all of the experience with demand response programs internationally. And I agree, you know, if it's simple, if it's usually fixed by time of day, if it's automated, and if it's kind of hardwired, although it doesn't need to be as hardwired as Economy 7 needed to be because technology's moved on since then it works and we can get it. But that doesn't mean that we won't need other sources of flexibility. And in particular, I think we're going to need some bulk storage. And if we're going to need bulk storage, we're going to need to provide, in my view, some off-market incentives to get that away, because it tends to have the same kind of characteristics as some of the big lumpy generation options have. You know, it's quite geographically constrained, might be perceived as being risky, at least at first. All for getting more batteries installed in a distributed sense around the system. That's been driven largely by contracts initially from National Grid for system services. But I don't think that's going to solve our kind of potential inter-seasonal problem. And I think that's a big problem. And demand flexibility can't solve that.
Well, I wonder, kind of come back to you again and see if you've kind of got any comments on what Rob's just said.
Well, I certainly agree with the last point that Rob made, that if you're going to de-risk generation, to me it makes sense to de-risk large-scale storage. But it also makes sense to consider de-risking parts of demand response at consumer level too. Because if you focus just on generation, then you bias the system towards generation. The government's own figures suggest we're going to have an excess of generation by the middle of the next decade for more than half the time, probably for about 2/3 of the time in the following decade. It just seems silly to plan our system around the idea of a huge excess of generation and not to consider the ways of balancing the system as a whole. And if you de-risk all that generation, that's what you'll get, an excess of generation. And I also think, as I've said before, it's vital to get the consumer voice in by forms of active consumer engagement, so you're getting a system that does respond to consumer preferences. The problem with the starting point that you de-risk, say, storage, and you de-risk interconnection and so on, is if government's deciding on everything, then the government is planning the system, as I say, around its own ideas, not around consumer preferences.
Well, look, Rob, you know, if I come back to you, because you argue against introducing strong locational elements in pricing via so-called locational marginal pricing, or LMP, you know, mainly on the grounds of the extra uncertainty it would create. But also, you acknowledge that the National Grid and many independent experts would advocate it strongly. So why are you not convinced by their arguments?
National Grid Energy System Operator. As you know, National Grid's been split. There's two bits of National Grid. One owns the assets and one's responsible for the operation of the assets. The latter have advocated very strongly for locational marginal pricing. The former are opposed to it. Right. So it's really, really important to understand that there are some very enthusiastic, strong advocates for locational marginal pricing. There's also some very well-informed stakeholders of various forms who are either lukewarm or opposed. And I'm not opposed to it. I just want to be absolutely clear. I understand entirely the arguments in favour of locational marginal pricing. my concern is that the REMA process was introduced with, in my view, an expectation of a fairly straightforward process which would introduce some fairly minor changes. It has disappeared down an LNP rabbit hole now. And that has become almost the only, has become the most controversial aspect of the proposals. And it risks becoming the only thing that anyone ever really thinks about and talks about. And my concern is there's a danger that you put the cart before the horse and you kind of lose sight of the things that I think Malcolm and I agree on that we were talking about just now around, you know, the system needs to be re-engineered so it's fit for purpose. You need new investment in cables in particular. And I do agree with everything that Malcolm just said about the role of the consumer, by the way. And you think that you can kind of fix the problem through a price signal that pushes generation around on the network, that it's to the convenience of the existing network. And the existing network was built in a previous century for a different set of objectives. And we need to build a network that's fit for purpose. And so my worry is that we become overly preoccupied with thinking we can do everything through locational price signals on the network and not focus on the real network issues that really matter, which is that we've basically the wires are in the wrong place. And on the distribution network side of things, even with all of the demand response and all of the smart stuff that you could possibly throw imagine, you know, you are still going to need to do upgrading because we're moving really significant loads across onto electricity that are currently, as I've said, are met by burning fossil fuels. Doesn't mean that I'm opposed to it in principle. I worry it's become a huge distraction.
Okay, Malcolm, well, I'd like to come back to you because, you know, you don't discuss transmission pricing in your papers. So, you know, do you think it's unimportant?
No, on the contrary, I think it is very important. I think that what we were trying to do was to design a system that would work with various different approaches to transmission pricing. I think it is very important because we're heading for a future in which zero marginal cost renewables are going to dominate the system. And as I mentioned before, we're going to have an excess of generation from those sources for most of the time. So you have to find some way of deciding which of these zero marginal sources are going to be dispatched at any particular time. And the key cost differences between them will not be in the generation costs, but the transmission costs. So I do think you need sharper locational signals in pricing. Whether that goes to the extent of locational marginal pricing, I'm a bit more neutral about for the sorts of reasons that Rob has given. The more you go in that direction, the more fundamental the change, the more uncertainty you introduce. But the general principle of introducing sharper locational signals and pricing in the future system is, I think, a valid one and an important one and does need to be discussed. But to the extent possible, I think it should be, which is not all the way, but to the extent possible, it should be kept separate from the argument, I think, about market arrangements as such.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Malcolm. Now, perhaps kind of we can have some final thoughts at the end of this podcast. So, Rob, have you got any final thoughts then?
In terms of what I would hope that the officials that are working on REMA do in the coming period, there's another consultation, a further round of kind of refining proposals due this coming autumn. It's be a bit clearer about the timelines for change. And I think that if they were clearer about how long there will be in a transitional period for, if we're talking about introducing LNP, you know, that would require some quite radical changes to the way the market's organised in order to enable it. That would probably require primary legislation. And so that requires parliamentary time. So there's a, you know, in consultation and so on. So I think it could be much clearer about how long it would be before change X could possibly be introduced. And that would really help, I think, to take the heat out of some of the discussions. It would probably help to build a bit more consensus around what could be done. I don't think we'll all agree on everything ever because some of it is pretty sort of fundamental and a bit more philosophical. But at the moment, there's a kind of, again, this kind of uncertainty about everything, which is very, very unhelpful. It must create a condition if you're looking in as a potential investor into the GB market, must make it seem very uncertain. And that would really, really help us, I think, to move forward. And then some of those crunchy decisions could get made. There's probably more agreement between Malcolm and I. I mean, I do still support quite a planned approach. probably perhaps a more planned approach than he does. But I totally agree with him about the need to keep the consumer and consumers engaged. This needs to work for consumers. And ultimately, what we need to be driving towards is more affordable electricity. If we're going to be electrifying things, it only really makes sense, you know, and will be a financially attractive proposition to people if you're electrifying things and those things are affordable or possibly even cheaper. And why not? You know, if we're going to be getting these technologies that are improving, we need this kind of smarter system, as Malcolm has been very clear about. You know, why couldn't we have a high level goal for future governments that we're not only going to have a more secure and cleaner electricity, but it's going to be cheap electricity as well.
So on that note, Malcolm, why did I come back to you for your comments? I speak from somebody who's tried to create a smart home with an EV, and I'll tell you now, you go out and buy the technology for creating that. It's not cheap, and the electricity is not cheap. So, Malcolm, why did I come to you for your final thoughts?
Well, I'm glad we can end on a note of more or less total agreement. I very much agree with what Rob's been saying. I think my chief worry is, as he said, a lack of swift progress. And I think part of the problem is, which we've not mentioned, when this process started, although Rob said there was no real political imperative, I think there was when the process started, because at the time electricity prices were going up because of rises in fossil fuel prices. And a lot of consumers were saying, well, look, we've had all this growth in renewables. And as Rob said, that might in principle bring down the cost, but we're not benefiting from that. And so a lot of the initial initiative and force behind it was the wish to separate fossil fuel prices from renewables prices, which were lower. That has rather faded away now. And my impression is the political will to do something has rather faded. And the realization that the problems are actually very complicated and there's no simple solution has rather come to the fore. So I'm worried, as he is, that it may all end up in a sort of process of stagnation and going nowhere in particular and endless consultation and reconsultation. It would be a great pity. So like Rob, I would like to see a clear outcome to this process as soon as possible. And I hope that we manage to achieve this.
Well, on that note, Rob, you know, and Malcolm, thank you both so much for your time today. You know, I really enjoyed our conversation that builds on the messages from the article, arguing over the fundamentals of market reform is undermining investment and impeding energy transition. That was published in the Institute's May 2023 Oxford Energy Forum publication that itself was titled Electricity Market Design During the Energy Transition and the Energy Crisis. And also, these matters were discussed in the 2017 OIS paper, The Decarbonized Electricity System of the Future, The Two Markets Approach. So I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this podcast. Thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our original research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.